Board Game Bros. Hello, listeners.
Hey.
It's another episode of the Board Game Brothers podcast. I'm Jeffrey Craig.
And I'm Matthew Craig.
We're brothers in real life.
And game designers in real life.
And this is our podcast where we talk about board games. So it's a end of the month, last week of the month episode. And for these episodes, we like to switch things up a little bit. And rather than just talking about one particular board game like we usually do, we like to open up to a broader topic and examine it in a little more detail, a little more nuance. Today we're inspired by a recent video game release. We've done a lot of video game episodes recently for these end of the month episodes.
Yeah, we're going to switch it back to board games, but...
Right, but we're being inspired by a video game.
Right.
And that video game is Sekiro, which is this recent video game from Activision and From Software. And how it inspired us to talk about board games is that it's a very difficult video game.
Right.
And because of its difficulty, and we've both been playing it lately, it made us think about difficult board games. And so we just wanted to talk about the concept of difficulty in board games in general.
Yeah.
So so let's start the conversation by saying, let's see. Why would you make a difficult board game in the first place, I guess, is where we can start.
Right, yeah. So difficulty in board games, I think, is, you would want to make a difficult board game because of some purpose for the difficulty. Like, you don't really set out to make a difficult board game first most of the time. Mm-hmm. Usually the difficulty is the second thing you think of. I know
right.
one big thing, which I think is... a major driving factor in the popularity of difficult games in general is just that it provides a challenge that's rewarding when it's overcome.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, you see this a lot with video games mainly, but it's the same with board games that when you have a difficult challenge posed upon you, you know, when you finish it, complete it, beat it, whatever, it just feels good, like you've conquered a task.
You've right. The sense of gratification that you get from beating a difficult thing greatly outweighs the frustration you get from failing to it
right.
over and over again. At least that's how it is in video games, certainly. And that's how it can be in board games.
Yeah.
But I will pose that in board games, you can only fail so many times.
Yeah.
It takes to just use the game that we've been playing as an example, the video game, you know, I will lose to something 20 or more times before I eventually beat it. And it will make it all worth it. But if I lost the same board game, even just 3 times in a row, I probably would never play it again.
Right. Difficult video games have the benefit of being instantly resettable, as mm-hmm. in like the game state that you started at can be immediately jumped back to. You know, that's why games like Super Meat Boy or Celeste were so good, because they instantly respawn you. Mm-hmm. But with board games, you do have to set up the entire game and, you know, and pack back up whatever the previous game was.
Mm-hmm. In addition to just playing a game, which a board game just takes longer to play than
typically,
a video
yeah.
game. At least a video game level, maybe, or yeah. a boss or something like that.
An individual yeah, challenge.
So in that regard, a difficult video game or a difficult board game isn't one that you fail at repeatedly until you eventually win, but it's more so something that tests you, and maybe you fail at once before you're able to understand it and finally beat it.
Right. One important thing is that I think to make a difficult game more good for or more appealing to replay, it's usually better to not have a binary win-lose state or like a binary punishment.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, a lot of games will do this by subtracting points in some regard if you fail to meet a certain goal or criteria. Mm-hmm. That way, it, you know, it punishes you for failing at the difficult part, but it doesn't, you know, outright say you lose.
Right.
Additionally, we touched on this in a few episodes by now, but the difficulty of a game can help the tone of the game, because difficulty tends to be a harsher like tone, harsher thing, especially mm-hmm. in board games where you're constantly stewing on your actions. You know, if you want like a dark game, a game with a dark theme, usually a darker or harsher mechanics and harsher difficulty will fit well with that.
Right. And maybe this is where I want to talk about a little bit about the psychographics that we like to mention every now and then.
Yeah.
Just that it's kind of obvious just from the topic that a spike would get a lot of pleasure out of a difficult game. Even I would say even a cooperative game, a spike would get a lot of pleasure from beating it.
Oh, yeah.
Which is interesting because a spike is usually interested in beating other players. Like they want to be the best at a game, understand the game and outplay other players. But a difficult game that directly challenges a spike could also give them some pleasure.
Yeah.
Just for defeating the game itself. But then also, if that difficulty comes from some sort of mechanical complexity, I could see how a Johnny would also find pleasure because a Johnny likes to tinker and tool with the elements of a game.
Right.
And develop a very deep understanding of them. And so a complex game that's difficult because of its complexity, mastering that could be a good thing for a Johnny. And then to talk about what you were just mentioning before this, a Vorthos and a Mel. And by the way, I don't think we've mentioned or defined Mel or exactly what these two psychographics represent, but these are the aesthetic psychographics that Wizards of the Coast developed that care about the aesthetic parts of the game. And essentially, it's just the difference between the mechanics of the game, the aesthetics of the mechanics, and the aesthetics of the flavor of the game.
Right. The Vorthos is all about the flavor of the game and how that ties in with the game itself.
Mm-hmm. And Amel likes very elegant or well-designed mechanics. Yeah. And I could see how both of those would get pleasure out of playing a difficult game. So in your example, a difficult game that has a very dark theme, like zombie apocalypse or plagues or whatever, would get a lot of enjoyment out of just playing through that kind of a story and getting into that the whole story behind the game. And that would make the mechanics acceptable versus a Mel who would find just the mechanics that make it difficult. If the mechanics are well designed, then a Mel would enjoy that. Like, for example, how like plague tokens would stack up and then when they overflow, they spread to nearby cities. That's an interesting, well designed mechanic that I think a Mel would enjoy.
Yeah. And I think it's also that having a harsher theme kind of. What's it like forgives the mechanics or like it, right. it lets you like kind of accept the difficult mechanics. So even if you lose, like it's in tune with the theme of the game. Mm-hmm. You know, when you sell somebody on a zombie apocalypse game, they kind of assume it to be kind of harsh and difficult.
Right.
So yeah, I think
go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, I think in general you would want to make sure that people playing the game know that the game is difficult.
Right. And when we get into like how to design a game and the different like parts of a difficult game that should be included, I think one of the big things is telegraphing and setting expectations. So we'll get to that in a little bit, but first, before we get there, I want to talk about what types of games benefit from being difficult.
Hold on.
Oh, go ahead.
I wanted to say one more thing difficulty serves is, difficulty that has like a sliding scale or like set difficulties. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, a hard mode and a medium mode and an easy mode, those tend to be, they tend to be good for like spikes, of course, because it is another challenge you can beat, but I think those just help a lot of players that like they can get into the game and then replay it in the full difficult mode and, you know, test themselves or just try it when they're more comfortable.
Right. And this is probably where you would say like the board game needs to have this versus a video game.
Yeah.
Because in a video game, again, you can die 20 times and then on the 21st time you beat it. In a board game, you can't lose to a game 20 times in a row. No one's going to do that with a board game. So you would instead have an easy mode that tests you just a little bit, but you're able to overcome it and develop an understanding. And then the next time you come back to a game, you can increase the difficulty so that even if you lose, you know, you know that you lost because of this, and you could go back and play the easy mode if you just want to experience the game, or you could just keep to develop that understanding and try it again. I don't know. I mean, you kind of get what I'm saying. You always have that option of playing the easy mode, or you could just start with the easy mode to get that first understanding so that when you go through the harder mode, you're not starting from a blank slate.
Exactly, yeah. Okay, so now that we've gotten that sort of out of the way, let's talk about the types of difficulty or the ways they manifest.
All right.
I want to start with an idea I want to pose, which is relative difficulty versus inherent difficulty. Because I think this kind of helps frame every other mechanic or type of difficulty, which is inherent difficulty is sort of how I would describe difficulty that's set by the designer and is baked into the game's mechanics without much like player determinism in terms of how it appears. So things like resource costs and resource amounts typically are these, or timers.
Like player action economy.
Yeah. Things that are static in the game's rules. Whereas relative difficulty is difficulty that's set by other players or comes from players' choices. So these are often things like I guess these are more limited resources that players can only have so many of. Or how hidden information is used is sort of a mix of these.
Mm-hmm.
In competitive games, usually timers come in more of a form of relative difficulty. So I just want to bring that up just sort of, like I said, to help frame everything else. Because difficulty is a pretty broad umbrella.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I like to think of it. In a couple other ways, like difficulty could come from just the game being an opposing force against you.
Right.
It's got a set of mechanics that you are fighting against directly in the game, and the strength of that mechanic is the difficulty of the game. And then I would also say that difficulty could come from just a complexity of the game.
Oh, sure.
A game with a lot of parts that's hard to grasp immediately is just kind of inherently difficult.
Sure, yeah. A game with a lot of areas to get good at, so to speak, is usually a game that's difficult for the early plays.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So if there's anything else, is there anything else you want to say on this topic?
On the broader things, not really, but I do want to go more in depth on a few difficulty focuses that a lot of games will use.
Okay.
So one thing is resources. I kind of touched on this a bit, but between resource costs and resource availability, this is a pretty common one in a bunch of different games. So what I mean is, like, if resources are scarce, and resources being, you know, things like typical money, materials, what have you.
Food.
Right. Or if resource costs are high in proportion to those, this can just be kind of like an early difficulty sort of roadblock.
Mm-hmm.
And also in competitive games, oftentimes these will be a limited resource that, like I said, is contested between players.
I want to attach to this the idea of like minimizing risk is something that would exist in a lot of difficult board games, especially ones where the difficulty comes from this lack of resources.
Yeah.
Where you have this lack of resources, and so you can only you can't do everything that you need to do. So you can only do some of those things. And deciding what things you do is where you master the difficulty.
Yeah,
because what you're trying to do is kind of minimizing your risk.
I actually have that written down as like decision overwhelming, where it's overwhelming the player's priorities, so it's hard for them to determine what to pursue.
Another mechanic that would feed into that is just player action economy. And I'm sure many people have experienced this, where you play a game and you just feel like you can't do enough on your turn. You are on your turns, plural. You just can't do enough. So you have to do as much as you can, or you try to do as much as you can. Maybe you spread yourself too thin and you fail.
Right.
Or maybe you just barely get by.
Yeah. Usually this is sort of a form of a timer in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, timers are also very common, especially in co-op games, for, like, just setting a limit for how much stuff you can do, or mm-hmm. how much stuff you can do before a mechanical shift happens. Not necessarily the game ends when this timer's up. So, yeah. And, of course, how much time you have to do your actions, even if there is no set limit of turns or whatever, also fits that. I do have loss aversion as a different thing than multiple priorities is the thing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I took this more like when there's very significant losses that are either imminent or possible, it can add a lot of tension and difficulty to the game. Things like characters dying or losing major payments or like things mm-hmm. that you've paid a lot for. Stuff like that. It doesn't appear as much, but those are, like, major difficulty sources.
Sure.
And then the last one I have is info obscurity. So this is, like, the backbone of a lot of deduction games. Just the game determining, like, what all is hidden information means that it'll be harder to make certain choices.
All right, so can we now talk about what kinds of games benefit from being difficult?
Yeah.
So first of all, I think it's pretty apparent that cooperative games benefit very greatly from having high difficulty or from having that difficulty slider like we mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, in a cooperative game, you win or lose as a group. So being able to share in that misery or in that success just kind of makes the difficulty a little more bearable for some.
Right.
But it gives a multiple minds working on the same problem. It can help. Yeah.
I was going to say it makes it harder for one person to solve every problem too.
Right.
Which helps prevent the quarterbacking problem that cooperative games can run into where one player just masterminds everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's also just that in competitive games, the main source of conflict comes between players. And for a cooperative game, you typically want there to be some sort of conflict. And so you would use it between the game's mechanics, which is what you have left. It's the designer and the players.
Mm-hmm. So it's also just very easy to control the difficulty when it's coming just from the game's mechanics and not from other players.
Yeah, usually these will have timers in them, mm-hmm. especially, you know, think of like Pandemic or Forbidden Island, where those timers are pretty baked into I use baked in a lot. They're like, they relate to just the other mechanics. They're there, they fit with everything else. They also use a lot of like scarce resources in these types of games. Mm-hmm. And I think this kind of goes to another type of game that uses difficulty, which is survival, which isn't necessarily always cooperative. There are mm-hmm. competitive ones or semi-cooperative ones like Dead of Winter.
Right.
Just these are the ones where like the resource limitations are at the most forefront and the most severe. Because the idea is you have to make do with what you have and make sacrifices for what you don't have.
How do you see difficulty in a competitive game when players are fighting against each other?
So this is a bit more of a complex one, because I mean, you can think of difficulty like how hard it is to win. Like, I mean, if there's one good player, that kind of feels like difficulty. But mm-hmm. I think a few major things are something I touched on earlier, which is competitive resources or like heavily contested and limited resources. You'll often see this with engine builder games, mm-hmm. with things like, you know, there's a pool of resources that only so many get added to the available amounts every turn, like in Agricola, where you put resources on spaces and then take them. Or, you know, things like the milestones and food chain magnate, which are first come, first serve.
Mm-hmm. And if you fail to take one on the same turn that somebody else takes one, then you lose out on it.
Yeah. Usually those are two big ones. And then, of course, like obscured info is the backbone of social deduction games. And those are almost always cooperative to some degree. So, like, you know, hiding certain info from the players can make it harder for them to make decisions, like I said. And those are that's more common in competitive games, I think.
Just because a game is competitive, though, does not mean that the game can't have mechanics that work equally against all players,
right?
Like in a cooperative game. Just to use Agricola for an example, it has scarce resources, but also you need to feed your family in that game. And if you fail to feed a member of your family, you lose points.
Right.
And that's just a mechanic in the game that equally affects all players. And if you don't plan for it, then you will lose points in the game. And that can be difficult to have to manage that in addition to earning points in the other ways of the game.
Oh, right. Yeah. And even then, Agricola also has the most or like some of the most harsh action timers, or like, you know, you only have so much time to do your stuff. Obviously, there's mm-hmm. a limit on the turn number, but the way the workers work means you have an even more limited amount of actions per round or whatever.
Right.
So, I mean, timers are used pretty often in competitive games in different ways, and even like beside the whole like action menu sort of action economy setup, there are a lot of competitive games that just have a turn number, mm-hmm. turn limit.
All right. So should we talk about how to make a difficult game?
Yeah.
So I think first of all, if you're going into a game wanting it to be difficult, it's going to take a lot of playtesting because
yeah.
you very much need to strike this balance where a first time player will either lose the first game but be able to win the second game, or they will win the first game but by a very narrow margin.
Yeah, I think in general you don't want your players to lose. You want it
if they do lose, I think you want to make it so that they know that they lost sort of early on into the play session. You wouldn't want them to play through the whole game and then lose.
Yeah.
You'd probably want them to say, like, we're losing this one. Let's reset because now I know how the game is played and now I know how to avoid what just happened.
Right. And you would usually want like it so that if they do lose, it's by very specific mistakes. Like, you don't want the player's mistakes to get muddled in with all the other actions they take during the game.
Mm-hmm. I will say though that I once played a game of Pandemic Cthulhu, and we lost on like the fourth turn just purely by the way the game played out. Like, I don't think we could have done much to have stopped what had happened. We would have had to like looked at the cards coming up to have
right.
known exactly what was going to happen in order to have lost that game. But I guess to the benefit of the game, it was a Cthulhu related game, so I was totally expecting to lose.
Yeah.
At some point. But in that example, we lost like immediately, and then we were like, well, let's try again because I think we just got super unlucky. And
yeah.
then the second time we won.
Yeah.
So there's some credence to saying like have it telegraphed so people know it's coming, but there's also something to saying like have some randomness in the game, so that, you know, it could happen as a surprise, but it won't be a bad thing. I guess don't put the randomness in there, but just know that it's not a bad thing, maybe is what I'm trying to say.
I mean, you wouldn't want it to end that early, you know, more often than not.
Right.
Or even yeah. like even like 40% of the time is too much. You want as few like non-games as possible, because then it feels like the players wasted their time if they didn't have
sure.
any time to react or play around it. So I think that's something to keep in mind, of course. But so first of all, like I would say, like, start with what kind of game you're making, and then think about sort of what forms of difficulty will fit in with that structure. So, you know, we mentioned what's often found in cooperative and what's often found in competitive games. I think that's usually like your starting point, per se.
Mm-hmm.
I think an important thing to keep in mind about difficulty is that you don't want the difficulty to mean that the players are not doing anything. you want the players to be doing something. So, like, difficulty that makes a player skip their turn or, like, take a very small action can feel way more restrictive than it is, like, tough. Like, you want the player to have fun even if they're having a hard time.
Right. And it's sort of like in a game with money where you move around the board. Like, you'd rather lose all your money than skip a turn.
Yeah, because skipping a turn just feels like you don't have any impact on the game. It's like you're waiting around on a table even longer than already. Whereas, like, losing your money, it sucks horribly, and it might mean roughly the same thing in terms of, like, the pacing and the mechanics, but they're at least doing something.
Yeah, if you lost all your money, you can do something else next turn.
Well,
or
you
can do,
like,
something else on that turn.
There's movement, there's action. Like, you're doing something that turn instead of nothing.
Yeah.
Something's better than nothing. And, you know, like, in that regard, just, like, or like, when there's difficult resource costs or, like, tight resources, I can still see that also being a harder thing to manage in terms of, like, doing something on a turn. I mean, a lot of games that have that type of thing will have, like, strictly worse resource spaces. So, like, Agricola has the 2 food guaranteed, or the food that builds up every turn. So, you know, stuff like that where, like, it does something. I mean, I think it still sucks to make, like, a suboptimal move there because you're forced to. But I guess at that point, you at least know that you want to get back to it as quick as possible in the next round or the next game.
So we're talking a lot about resource costs and player actions, and
right.
I want to mention now that a good way to add difficulty in the game and to adjust the difficulty is to have tons of levers in your game. Levers and knobs, yes. So a lever and a knob is just a name for, like, a mechanic that you can adjust. It's a mechanic that has a variable to it.
Yeah.
So how much resources you acquire from a space, how much resource do you spend on a thing, how many spaces you move on your turn. All these things are levers and knobs that you can adjust, and finding that sweet spot where the game is difficult but winnable is, you know, you can reach it very easily by having all these levers and knobs that you can adjust. In addition, having a lot of levers and knobs just means that your game is going to be a little more complex than others, and complexity is another place to get some difficulty.
Right, yeah. Let's see. So
there's something we mentioned early on that I want to talk about now, and that is being able to predict your downfall,
yeah.
or being able to see the danger on the horizon, which is very important. And that can come both before you even start playing the game. Like we mentioned earlier, if the theme is something very dark, like Pandemic Cthulhu, which is mixing disease and
Cthulhu.
Otherworldly monsters and horrors that we cannot possibly fathom. Cthulhu, yeah. You know, going into that game, you know you're about to play something that's going to punish you and it's going to be difficult and you may lose to it.
Prepare to die edition.
Exactly. To go back to From Software. But in addition to that, having the thing that you need to worry about in the game being something that you can see coming. So, like, in Pandemic, you see the disease tokens piling up on the board, and you know that if you let it go unchecked for too long, that it will overflow and start spilling to other towns. So you can see that coming, and then you can act on it early on. In Agricola, you know when you have to feed your family. It tells you after this round and after this round and after this round, you have to feed your family, so you need to prepare before then.
Yeah, and the amount of food is easy to calculate.
Mm-hmm.
Or Dead of Winter, you have these big old zombie standees that are standing up on the different spaces. I think in general, having more of something is easier to notice than having less of something. If that makes sense. So, like, a pile of cards that runs out, I mean, it's only easy to see that it's near the difficult, or, like, near the big problem area when it's really low. Otherwise, it's hard to tell the difference between, like, 20 and 28 cards, for example, in a deck. at a glance at least. Whereas like having a big stack of something, or, you know, having a bunch of something in a pile, like that's very easy to look at and see and say, oh man, that's getting to be a problem.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess a stack of cards in general is just a hard thing to guess.
Count, yeah. Yeah, that's fair.
Inherently, but yeah.
Let's see. I think if you want to add, sliding difficulty, there are a few things to keep in mind. One of which is upkeep costs, as in like, so when a player has to remember to do something constantly, it's not something that they do on their turn that they have to remember as change, but like, you know, revealing more cards in Forbidden Island or something like that. I think Pandemic also does that. It's like, you have to keep in mind how many of those there are. So Forbidden Island and Pandemic, you flip over so many cards that act as the timer. But that's like the only thing you have to remember to do. So It's pretty basic. But like, it's sort of a problem of like very specific levers that you want to avoid being things that the player doesn't interact with of their own volition. Whereas like if it's something like you know, whenever a player takes an action of a specific type, they you know, lose points or there's a danger. Like in Dead of Winter, when you move from the the like stronghold, whatever, to one of the surrounding buildings, you roll a die and you have a risk of getting hurt or bitten. It's like that's something you interact with of your own accord, so it's easier to remember that way, at least in my experience.
Sure.
Yeah. I want to bring up the like very, very strict punishments. So things like, you know, losing a character from getting bitten in Dead of Winter, or getting your action canceled in something like Broom Service. So with these sort of ideas, they're really bad because they negate a lot of work. I think a lot of games will only have like one, maybe two of these instances where it's like a very, very strict loss. At least from what I've seen. And I think in general you'd want to limit yourself to maybe one at most, where like it can negate, you know, five turns of work on a particularly bad example.
I think maybe the idea here is that you would want to design something that penalizes you very early on. It doesn't penalize your hard work, but it slows your production, your productivity.
Yeah. And if there's
you're not like destroying their efforts after they've done it. You're just kind of like preventing them from doing, you're taking away from them before they've done that so far. Yeah.
And if there's something that penalizes you like mid to late game pretty heavily, make sure you can see it from a mile away.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
Spirit Island, you know, the blight as it spreads around. Eventually it gets to be a big problem, but you can tell when that's going to happen because of the queue of cards that will get flipped over to show what areas are being affected.
Spirit Island also provides an interesting example because it has that like accumulation and that spread, that physical element to the threat that is growing, that you can see is growing. But then it also has the very important thing that you need to look at isn't necessarily those pieces, but it is the card that is showing where the pieces are going to spread to next.
Yeah, and what's good about that... Oh.
I was just going to say that it's an even more direct telegraph, which is fine. Like, it's...
Yeah.
Spirit Island is a fairly difficult game, but it is very upfront. It tells you three turns in advance what you need to worry about blatantly. Right.
I was going to say, and in terms of the game structure and pacing, like the first thing you do on the invader turn or whatever is you flip over those cards and move them. So like you look at the cards first and then you do the stuff on the board, which I think helps give them an importance. Like, you're looking at the territories and the land and stuff so many times, or the cards, I mean, that are being flipped over. You're looking at those cards so many times during a turn, So like you're guaranteed to see that there's something big upcoming mm-hmm. is what I'm getting at.
In Pandemic, they keep that information hidden from you. You can sort of guess it because you're essentially in Pandemic cycling through like the same 10 cards on the top of the deck and reshuffling them and drawing them again. So you can have an idea of when they're coming up, but it's still hidden to you before it happens.
Yeah.
I think both cases are something to consider in your game. Like if you have if the mechanic that is the threat against your players can be telegraphed, you know, it does telegraphing it really make the game too easy?
Yeah. Like Pandemic is definitely one where the action economy you have isn't enough at times.
Mm-hmm.
I would say.
Whereas, and I think now we're in a spot where we're just kind of just identifying difficult games and how they use their difficulty, we can just sort of. Oh, go ahead.
I was going to say, I just remembered a type of difficulty we didn't even bring up, which is difficulty in communication. This is most common in cooperative games. Things like Magic Maze or even Code Names. You know, the difficulty in these stems in the limitations on, or the mind, you know, big popular one now. The difficulty comes in the methods at which you can communicate versus what the game forbids.
Right.
Okay, yeah. So should we just talk about some like games to study if you want to make a difficult game, or maybe if you're looking for some to play?
Sure. I mean, yeah, if you're looking for some to play.
Yeah.
Sure. So we've already mentioned a couple games. So let's go back over through them. We mentioned Agricola.
Right. We did an episode on this and we kind of went to the conclusion that it was very difficult.
Mm-hmm. The players are constantly fighting over resources, and the whole time you have to feed your family, which is points penalty against you. And the whole game is themed as farming in the Dark Ages, which makes sense for the fact that you have to feed your family and that you're going to be penalized for it and that the resources are strict. But in that game, at least the visuals are not very indicative of the punishment that you're about to go through. So I guess visuals are also an important thing in making your game. The theme is important, but so is making that theme apparent visually.
Right. We mentioned Dead of Winter, which is a zombie survival game that's semi-cooperative. There is a hidden traitor mechanic, but for the most part, it has a lot to deal with just like fighting these building hordes of zombies and not letting your people die while mm-hmm. scavenging for resources. And there's a lot of tension because there's a lot of randomness that could end badly. And mm-hmm. a lot of it adds these zombies that are like these huge, not huge, but they're cardboard standees, like I mentioned earlier, which definitely added this, like, they literally stick out from the board.
Mm-hmm. And that game is one where the game asks you to do possibly too much. Like, because you have to feed the people that are in the compound that you're surviving in. You also have to collect items to reach an end game, but then you also will have like this minor problem that you have to address by collecting other kinds of items. So like between these three goals, oftentimes you can't always do all three. Also, like you mentioned, there's a hidden traitor aspect, and the traitor is sort of incentivized to secretly sabotage those minor goals.
Yeah.
In the game. And so, there's also players just kind of working against that fact that the thing that you already barely have enough time to manage.
Yeah. And a big part of Dead of Winter is that a lot of the difficult changes or additions are because of the player's own actions. Things like to get supplies you need at a higher chance, you make noise, which can attract zombies.
Mm-hmm.
So like there's a lot of tension in the way the player actually sets the difficulties for themselves.
Right. You incur the risk yourself.
Yeah. Then we mentioned Spirit Island.
Right. This is a completely cooperative game. It's pretty complicated.
Yeah.
Because it's a game where there's an island and there's bad pieces spreading across it, and you use cards with effects on them to push them back and defeat them. But every player, it plays a different character with a different set of cards with different complicated actions on them.
And different play styles.
Different play styles, and you can only manage, you know, one part of the board at the start of the game. It takes a while to spread out to other parts that you can help the other players. So there is a lot of complexity that adds to the difficulty in this game. Plus the game is just designed in such a way and balanced in such a way that if you're not careful at the start of the game, then things can get out of hand.
Right. You're almost like forced to address the problem from turn one.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah.
However, in that game, it gets to a point. So there's the thing about these games where things kind of spread exponentially, where if you're able to stop the spreading at some point and overcome it and overtake it, like with your own actions, your action economy is able to overtake the action economy of the opposition. Then the back part of that game is very easy.
Right. It's like the victory lap, like the falling action.
Yeah, and that can be a good thing.
Yeah, I think it's a nice relief when that happens. It feels like you've finally overcome it and that you're like really powerful. And it's nice because you see the fruits of your efforts happening. It's not like you overcome it and then you win. It's you overcome it and then you feel really good about it for the last few turns. Because you're still seeing how strong you are.
We mentioned the mind as a difficult game, which is interesting because the sliding scale of difficulty is a part of the game. Like when you play the game, you have to use that sliding scale. The game is essentially you just play it and it gets harder and harder as you play it because the iterations are so quick.
Right. But it's also really easy to set up every time because it's just shuffling and dealing a deck. Mm-hmm. So it's one where, like, when we first played it, we didn't get that far at all, but we played it, like, five times in a row.
Yeah. That is one game, yeah. If you can design a game with that kind of a speed, then even though the game itself is iterations of itself, and so we played it five times, but essentially every time we played it, it's like we played it four times.
Yeah.
I mean, that's 20 times. That's that benchmark that I was talking about that I just drew up randomly for the game that we started talking about at the beginning of this. But yeah, something that fast, so that quickly to iterate on, that's okay if you lose at it. And the whole point, and actually this is another thing, the whole point of that game is that you're just trying to go as far as you can until you lose.
Yeah.
So there is a way to design a game, and this is something I guess we didn't really talk about the whole episode. It's an arcade game. You will lose this game. That's the whole point, is just to see how far you can go before you lose.
It's a high score game, yeah.
And so, yeah, and this is maybe just in itself an entirely different kind of difficult game that we haven't really touched on in any of this discussion, because a lot of what we're talking about is this delicate balance of beating the game. In this case, it's just playing a game until you can't.
Honestly, I think I think one of my favorite things is when engine builders have like score sheets, just because it encourages you to keep track of your high scores, which adds this, you know, high score element of, you know, I want to beat my current record, but it's going to take a lot of work, you know, that type of stuff.
Go ahead.
I was going to say that makes it difficult without making it difficult.
Right. We mentioned Spirit Island, or not Spirit Island, Forbidden Island is another island-based game we mentioned, which is actually, like, as far as cooperative games go, a very easy game in its easiest mode. But Forbidden Island is very aware of how to adjust that difficulty, and the harder levels of that game can be very difficult.
Right, yeah, for sure. Let's see, I think I briefly mentioned Food Chain Magnate as a like really brutal engine building game because it has some of the most like most important first come first serve contested resources. So maybe play that if you really want to see like what a difficult engine building game would be from that standpoint. And I mentioned Broom Service, which is like half resource management, half deduction, but the deduction is so important that it makes the resource management part difficult.
All right. Is there any other games you can think of that we may have mentioned or that we should mention?
I would recommend checking out our Power Grid episode from last week.
Mm-hmm.
That we kind of touched on some elements of difficulty in that game as well. And of course, right. I mean, the episodes for all the other games we've covered.
Right. I think every game we've mentioned.
Spirit Island, Agricola, Food Chain Magnate.
Forbidden Island.
Forbidden Island. Yeah.
Yeah. We did episodes on all those, so if you're interested, you can check those out, and you can find those in our end of the episode plug section, which I think we're going into right now.
Yep.
Does that sound good? Yeah. All right, end of the episode plug. So you can follow us on social media at BG Bros Cast on Facebook and Twitter. You can go to our website, bgbcast.com, where we post all of our episodes. We have them all tagged with the games that we talked about in them, so if you want to find any of those episodes, you can go through the tags and find them, or you can just go digging through our library of episodes. You can also find a link on that website to our TeePublic store. That is teepublic.com/user/BGBcast. That is where you can buy our t-shirts with our cool, cool podcast logo on them. And that will do it for – if you'd like, you can follow us on any podcasting listening platform and leave comments for us. We do appreciate those comments.
Also, we have our podcast listed on BoardGameGeek, where you can become a fan on that, and you can also post in the discussion there, the forums and etc. So if you're interested, you can always, you know, talk to us on there, or just, yeah, discuss it.
Sure. And that'll do it for BG Bros plug, so we can go into Matt plugs now.
Right. Also, on our website, I write articles/blog posts. My most recent one was one on Kaizo Mario, which is a sort of concept of a specifically difficult Mario World custom ROM hack levels. So if you're interested in more difficulty in video games, that is a pretty good one to check out. But also, my next article is going to be over Sekiro Shadows Die Twice. So that should be up next weekend. The 6th. Additionally, I stream at twitch.tv/twack. That's twitch.tv/twak. I stream usually from 10 or 11 a.m. Central Time to 2 or 3 p.m. Central Time, give or take an hour. And I play a lot of competitive games. I play a lot of roguelites. I play a fair amount of difficult games myself, so if you want to come check it out and see me die a bunch. And I also just talk about games and game design and whatnot on those streams. And through that Twitch page, you can check out a Discord server where you can talk to us through there.
All right, very cool. Mm-hmm. And that'll do it for our discussion on difficult games. Thank you for listening.
Thank you for listening.
And we'll see you next month.